Hey, good day, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. I am Eric Rubenstein. I'm Advise Health's Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse. And again, I'm joined by my two compadres from the OIG, Wade McFall, retired Assistant Special Agent in Charge from the LA Field Office, and Matt Kachansky, a retired senior leader from HHS OIG's headquarters, as well as the now recently retired UPIC Northeast Director. We have a special guest today. We're going to be changing the format up a bit, starting to bring in some people to join us on the roundtable and kind of get some opinions from them on different things within the OIG and the greater fraud, waste, abuse space. I'm joined by my good friend, professional colleague, Sean Weiss. If you know Sean, you know that he is known as the compliance guy, or the compliance guy, depending on who you're talking to. And he is a partner with a company called Doctors Management. We do a lot of work with Doctors Management. I've known Sean for quite a bit. If you are familiar with the fact that we also have a separate podcast that we do together, we thought it would be a good idea to have Sean on and talk a little bit about the trials and tribulations, is what we'll call it, on working with OIG cases, working with the U.S. Attorney's offices and things of the like. For those of you who keep track of bios and things of that sort, you know that Sean has been in the space for almost 30 years as a compliance officer. He's got about a dozen different certifications that are all relative to coding and compliance and the like. And he really is the go-to guy for a lot of these things. And I rely on Sean for a lot of the professional things that go on in the space because he's always up on these things. So Sean, I'm excited to have you here on our podcast versus having us on your podcast for a change. So thanks for coming on for the next half hour or so.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I want to jump right in, and you know, we talk a lot, and we talk probably more times than most people, you know, talk. You and I talk both professionally and personally, but you know, you've had a string of cases that you've been brought in on recently that were relative to trials. They were Department of Justice trials. OIG, FBI were involved in those trials. And you've gotten three acquittals or two acquittals most recently on a few of these trials with some of the law firms that you've worked with. And they're complicated cases, right? I mean, people don't bring consultants and advisors in on kind of run-of-the-mill cases. So I want to talk about like some of that granularity of the complexity of these cases. And it's not so much the complexity of the case, but the complexity of the testimony that comes out of them. So kind of just give us in very broad strokes, what were the issues that were at hand that led to the indictments of the individuals that we're talking about?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. So the last three cases that we had acquittals on were combination cases. They were tied directly to Substance Control Act violations, which we could get into because it's very interesting with the last of the written majority opinions from the Supreme Court Justice Breyer. If you've not read the Ruan position paper by Justice Breyer, it was his last majority opinion that he ever wrote, and he saved the best for last. It was probably his most brilliant writing that he's ever done, and it had a significant impact on one particular case. And it was absolutely crazy because the majority opinion was released on the day that jury instructions were being read in the Dr. Bothra and Dr. Lewis et al. Case, which was United States v. Bothra and Lewis et al. So all three of these cases, Jeffrey Campbell, Bothra, Lewis et al., and the most recent one, which was Leslie Pompey, all three of them were Substance Control Act violation cases. And then indictments on 31 USC 1349, which is conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud. So these were extremely complicated cases. And, you know, I think the reasons why we were successful in these cases on and the Campbell case, we knew going into that one, we were not going to get a full acquittal on that one. We told Dr. Campbell that we felt that on the lesser of the charges on the healthcare fraud, especially the ones tied to incident two billing, because there was just no argument for those. They were done wrong, that he would most likely be found guilty of violation of, you know, at least one count of submitting a false claim. But it didn't result in anything significant from, you know, fines or jail time or anything like that. In the Bothra case, it was 54 counts against this provider and 54 count total acquittal. And then in the Pompey case, 38 count indictment, 38 count acquittal. So what I try to explain to attorneys that are taking on these cases, you know, white collar criminal defense attorneys, physicians, nurse practitioners, healthcare professionals, hospitals, nursing facilities that are in these positions, from the onset of notification that you are being investigated, you got to get subject matter experts involved who can get out ahead of this stuff, can do the heavy lifting, can get into trenches, roll up their sleeves, do the, you know, the statistical sampling, review the audits, do all of the things that need to be done, because that's the opportunity to go in and do a reverse proffer with a prosecutor to convince them that going forward with either convening a grand jury or moving to a trial is a bad idea. And here are all the reasons why.
Yeah, those are interesting points. And I think, you know, the big take home for us is getting in front of things sooner than later, right? We talk all the time about being in the driver's seat and not being in the passenger seat, right? It's a little bit like when we talk about self-disclosures, that if you're doing a self-disclosure, you're in the driver's seat. What you don't want to be is you don't want to be in the back passenger seat, because then you've got no control, you know, whatsoever. But so let's talk for a little bit about, you know, you've had some instances where you've interacted with OIG agents or FBI agents, and obviously, you know, the Matt and Wade and I come from a different cloth, but, you know, we understand that. And, you know, you've given some examples in some of the conversations that you and I have had about the behavior that you've seen and that you've heard, you know, from some of the cases you've worked on. And, you know, I think the important takeaway is that the things that you do during a search warrant or the things that you say during interviews will, you know, will come back. So, you know, and Wade and Matt, you know, in their careers, they stopped being working agents and moved up. You know, Wade supervised squads of agents, Matt supervised squads of agents, you know, regional projects, national projects, and was, you know, at points was the face of OIG on the Hill, and interacted with CMS and all of that. So, you know, the perception is reality. You know, so there's one story that I know that you like to share. So I want to share that. And then I want to go to Wade to kind of get his thoughts on, you know, kind of the head scratcher of it.
Yeah. And look, I think you said something that was really profound. And, you know, the four of us, I think, all come from pretty much the same generation, right? We're all pretty close in age, although Eric looks much older than all of us. You know, so I want to be careful with how I say things, because I have a tremendous amount of respect for the career law enforcement professionals at the Office of Inspector General, at the Department of Justice, at other investigatory agencies. I've made a lot of friends over the years, and I tell people, you know, having these relationships and knowing that, you know, they recognize that I'm never going to lie to them. I'm never going to withhold, you know, well, I'm going to withhold critical pieces of information that are in our favor until the right time. But, you know, nothing that would obstruct an investigation or hinder their ability to do their job. Because we always make bona fide, you know, disclosures. So I want to be careful about how I say things. But the four of us, I believe, you know, are cut from a different cloth than the younger generations that are out there today. I think we look at things from a civility standpoint. I think we recognize that the way that you conduct an investigation, the way that you put out a public notice of seizure, of search warrant, you know, these things have a adverse impact on, you know, persons' lives. And we're not talking about Sean the janitor at a hospital. We're talking about physicians who have spent the better part of their lives getting educated to be able to scientifically take care of patients. Now, there are some bad apples. There's some bad actors out there. There's no doubt about it. But I would say the percentage of those is probably around 2 to 3% of the healthcare professionals out there. You know, 2 to 3% of them are really kind of the bad actors, the ones who are willing to take those chances to dip their toe over the line. You know, I get to teach courses, you know, like the Prosecutor's Playbook. That's one of my favorites to teach, right? Because we talk about strategy. We talk about, you know, what corporate compliance programs are, what they should be looking for in a corporate compliance program based on DOJ, Criminal Department Evaluation of Corporate Compliance Program guidance, right? So it's always fun to do that. But to your point, one of the guidance points that I make to anyone conducting an investigation, whether you're on the defense side or you're on the prosecution side, be careful of what you say, be careful of how you say it, and be careful of what you put in writing, because those things will come back to you. As a prime example, you know, it came out during a case that one of the agents from the Office of Inspector General, when they served their search warrant, this individual was going around high-fiving people inside the person's home that they just took into custody, saying, you know, we just got the SOB, in front of their wife, in front of their children, their grandchildren. And, you know, to me, there's nothing professional about that. You have just impacted somebody's life. Now, you may believe that they're guilty, but that's not the way that our justice system works. Everybody is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law by their peers. So for you to come out and say, we got the SOB, and high-fiving people and laughing and making jokes, highly unprofessional, in my opinion. And that was one of the things that came out at trial, and it just destroyed this agent's credibility. And that person had to sit there at the table and look the jury in the eyes and see the, you know, the ire on the part of the jury, because they're putting themselves in that physician's place of being, you know, raided, handcuffed, and now an agent's running around high-fiving people and saying, we got the SOB. So bad. And I think that's one of the things that just absolutely destroyed the prosecutors in that case. One of many things that destroyed their case.
Yeah. So I want to go to Wade, because, you know, Wade was, as an ASAC, he's a field agent supervisor, right? So Matt, you know, spent most of his time at headquarters. So once he got to headquarters and was kind of in an administrative supervisory capacity, he's not going out on search warrants anymore. He's not making arrests. He's just moving, you know, his skill set is changing. And while Wade's skill set was changing, he's still field level, which means, you know, if there's a search warrant or an arrest warrant, he may or may not be going out on these things. And it's not uncommon that when we're on a search warrant or an arrest that a supervisor comes out, particularly if there's a large dollar amount, if it's high profile, you know, to kind of just be that if it's a multi-agency thing. So I want to go to Wade. And, you know, Wade is a guy who, you know, supervised agents for a long time on these kinds of things, and just kind of get your take on, you know, what do you expect out of people when, you know, you're going on a search or an arrest warrant? And more importantly, as a supervisor, did you feel the need to give these like pep talks to your agents? And when I say pep talk, I mean admonishment talk.
Yeah, well, first of all, I agree that that sounds terribly unprofessional. And, you know, the agents might, like you said, they might have that kind of thought in the back of their head. If they've been living and breathing this case, they have a certain feeling on, you know, how it's going to end up and the level of guilt of things. But to react like that is totally uncalled for. You know, the agents want to make sure they turn over every stone and don't miss things. But to have that kind of reaction in front of family members is just not good. And I think part of my job as an ASAC was somewhat that of a teacher and coach a little bit, whereas I would venture to say that none of my agents would have done that, not to be like we had the best region or anything like that, but like I got to know my agents pretty well, and there was a bit of coaching and things like that, but that's just really, in my opinion, common knowledge that you don't react like that at a you know, a search warrant or an arrest warrant or something like that. So and it's true that I would be out there sometimes. A lot of times it was more of a high profile case where we thought there was going to be press. But I didn't necessarily feel like I needed to be there because I was afraid a reaction like that would happen. That would have never crossed my mind. So it's kind of a different purpose for me being out there. But again, I think that because I worked hand in hand with the agents, you know, on a daily basis, and, you know, unless somebody new came, we used to get agents from other agencies that transferred over. So maybe I didn't know them as well, but part of my job is to know the agents, and I should have known if that was going to be a reaction from somebody. So I think it's really just a matter of somewhat coaching and, you know, having discussions, and we do a lot of training. So the agents should know that you don't have that kind of reaction. It's just very unprofessional. And as Sean said, it's going to come back to bite you, especially in trial. That's going to come up. Those kind of things don't just get swept under the rug. So that's now part of your legacy as an agent. That's probably what you're going to be known for. So you really have to guard against that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it is. And it is an interesting thing, because I do think that that is somewhat of a regional discussion as well. Right. So the agent that we're talking about was in an office in a place in the country that probably didn't do a lot of criminal related work at the time. And so, you know, being in New York and New Jersey, where 95% of the cases that we worked on were criminal, there was a lot of experience that you gleaned over the years from search warrants and arrests. And you just become, you know, you never put your guard down, but you just become professional at doing them. You know, we were doing, you know, LA, you know, Miami, your bigger cities, you're doing arrest and search warrant operations almost on a weekly or every other week basis. There's something going on. So you just become a little bit better at being professional about doing it. So it doesn't take away the fact that there's a level of professionalism that should exist in that. And, you know, at the end of the day, Sean, you're right. These are things that come to bite you. And the things that you don't think are going to come out in a trial will come out, particularly as a case agent. You know, I had 8 or 9 trials in my career, and you're sitting there and they're putting you on the defense because you're the case agent. You're the one that did all of the work and all of that. So, you know, it's just one of those things. But you're right. This is like just general advice, because when you as a consultant come in and it's trial mode, you're not just there to consult. And, you know, you and I have worked together on a bunch of these projects, Wade and Matt and I, we've all worked on these kind of things where when we're making these assessments about the triability of a case, we're really looking at things that are going to be bad facts. And a bad fact could be something like that. It's going to come out, you know, in a trial that people were high-fiving. And the truth of the matter is that at the end of the day, even if a little of that is literary freedom, you know, maybe they weren't high fives, maybe they were handshakes, or, you know, but, you know, the game of telephone really. But if you put yourself in a position where all of those things are occurring versus just we have a search warrant, we have an arrest, and then just kind of being done and moving on, you definitely tamp down the temperature, but you also tamp down all of the noise that's going to surround it, you know, later on. So, Matt, go ahead. You got something on this?
Yeah, I was going to say it goes beyond, you know, behavior at the, you know, the raid site. It's, you know, if you remember your precedents back in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, there was a case involving a U.S. senator where it was found that the investigators made comments in text messages, in voicemails to the prosecutor about the senator and how guilty they were, and this was fraud and things like that, making these conclusory, very subjective statements. Those then became discoverable. So it's not just what you say at the site that happens to be being videotaped. It's everything that you put on paper, any message that you leave to a prosecutor, all of that has to be saved, and all of that goes to the defense. So agents, right, at the federal level, investigators for the SIUs and the UPICs, all of that has to be, you have to have that in the back of your mind anytime you're putting something to paper or saying something that's in what you think is a private setting, but is actually public.
Yeah, that's a really great point.
And you know, that's another thing that now even more so, but even when I was retiring, it was the agents had to know that it's common knowledge that everybody has a video recorder in their phone. So you should assume that everything you're doing is being recorded, even beyond the fact that every text and every email is recoverable, but everybody's got a phone now. So you should just be assuming that there's three or four phones recording every move you make, especially at something like a search warrant or an arrest warrant.
Yeah, I mean, towards the end of my career, so I retired in January of 19, and probably in the last 2 years before I retired, when we do our quarterly enforcement training, our firearms and our tactics and our scenario-based training, we started incorporating in situations where there was an arrest or a search warrant and people bringing in cameras and the like. But, you know, so Sean, I want to talk a little bit about appeals and redeterminations, reconsiderations in the ALJ, but what are some of the things that you've identified along the way in your trials and tribulations that the government does right?
So, look, you know, I think right versus wrong could be subjective, right? I think it comes down to the outcomes to make a determination as to whether things were done by the book or whether or not there was some gaps in the process, right? I think there are things that the government could do better. And when I say that, since some of these cases have come out where I was the only witness on the defense side for, you know, challenging the government's allegations of healthcare fraud violations, you know, I'm getting a lot more calls from investigatory agencies. Would I be willing to look over some of, you know, their information? I'm getting calls from prosecutors asking if I, you know, have been retained in this case. And if not, would I be willing to work on the prosecution side? And here's what I tell people. As long as you're making full disclosures, as long as you have not acted like the judge, jury, and executioner in this case, I'm willing to engage and I'm willing to talk about what you have identified as potential liabilities on the part of an organization. I think for me, because I've, you know, and I would say of the 40 criminal civil cases that I've done in just the last, 5 years, I would say 80% of the work I've done has been on the defense side, 20% has been on the prosecution side. I have found more flaws in the government cases than I've actually found good work. And I think there's reason for that. I think there's a lack of training. I think there's a lack of understanding for how healthcare works. I think agents need to recognize that this is the business of medicine. And the clinical aspect of it, even though it should be 100% of everything that we look at in healthcare, it's not. The business aspect really drives everything that goes on. There's a section in the Medicare Program Integrity Manual, it's Chapter 3, that specifically starts off by saying, agents of the Office of Inspector General, special agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and prosecutors need to understand how Medicare works. Literally, it starts off with that. And, you know, Wade and Matt, you know, Eric, y'all being, you know, former, I shouldn't say former because that's a nefarious term, retired, you know, OIG agents, you know, you would look at that and you would say, okay, you're right. If I'm going to investigate Medicare, maybe I need to understand what Chapter 8, Section 8.4 of the Program Integrity Manual is referring to when it starts talking about statistical sampling. And when I can statistically, you know, when I can deploy a statistical sample into a practice, you know, how do I test it? You know, do I use a Monte Carlo simulation? Do I use Cochrane's theory to test it? You know, how do I do this to make sure that, you know, there's no holes in my process? When I'm looking at evaluation and management documentation guidelines, you know, have our agents been trained to understand that prior to 2021, which is really what all of these cases I've been working on have been tied to, right? It's everything prior to the change in E&M services. If you're going to use things like the medically unbelievable day, well, you can't say that you're relying on typical times, right? Because typical times, when it came to time for an E&M service prior to 2021, meant that if you're going to bill a 99213 based on time, which is 15 minutes, that greater than 50% of that encounter had to be dominated by counseling and or coordination of care. You can't say, well, you billed me for a 99213, but you didn't spend 15 minutes with the patient. It's irrelevant. And these are the lessons that I actually had to teach to the prosecutors. And I will share this with you. As you know, post-trial, the attorneys get to question the jurors as to why they acquitted or why they found somebody guilty. And Ron Chapman shared in the last case, which was Leslie Pompey, the jury said that Sean Weiss was the most impactful and most compelling witness of the entire trial because he was able to take something that the prosecution was declaring was so complex and so brutally impossible to understand, and that it was definitive, that it could only be this way and there was no other way to look at it. And Sean basically came in and said, look, here's the truth. This stuff is not as complex as people want to make it out to be if you just drill down to the fundamentals of what these services are. And as long as you recognize that medicine is an art, it's not an exact science, and that's why they call it the practice of medicine. And you recognize that mistakes, innocent mistakes, don't make somebody guilty, right? We're not claiming stupidity on the part of the providers, but what we're saying is that there's a difference between erroneous and fraudulent. And here are the differentials between that. So for me, I think the big mistakes that the prosecution made, and I know I'm kind of, it sounds like I'm dumping on them, but maybe they'll learn their lesson, right? You know, the big mistakes that I see on the prosecution side is not going outside of their special agents at OIG or FBI and bringing in subject matter experts from the private sector to be able to opine on it. Look, as you said during the introduction, I've been doing this now. This year will be 30 years I've been working in healthcare. I've dedicated my life to this industry as a life learner, right? And that means there's not a day that goes by that I'm not reading, educating myself, trying to understand the rules, the regulations, and how to apply these things in everyday, you know, business. But the prosecution, I was shocked in the Bothra case, $450+ million, you know, 54 counts of indictment. They did not have a coding, billing, documentation, or compliance expert who testified. I was shocked. You put somebody like me on the stand with 10 national board certifications, and now all of a sudden you have nobody to refute what I'm saying, and you have a prosecutor who doesn't know the first thing about coding, and they're getting taken to school. It's a problem for the government. It's wonderful for the defense counsel, but it's horrible for the prosecution.
You know, it's interesting you bring that. So that is an interesting challenge. And I can't, what amazes me is that if you have a case that involves anything involving a CPT, a HCPCS, a DRG, an ICD-10, anything that involves coding and billing as the salient part of your case, if it's not a bribery case or a drug diversion case, and it involves anything in which a claim is being paid for an item, service, or procedure, why wouldn't you want an expert on the stand, at the minimum, someone to explain the program to a lay jury? Because what a lay jury may not understand is that, hey, when a doctor submits a claim to Medicare, it's not going to Washington, D.C. It's going to some third party with a contract, right? So it's like this education piece that comes in. It's really an amazing thing. And I'll tell you, you know, for us here, you know, we're fortunate enough that we've got people here who have that requisite expertise. We've got some people here who are RN auditors who worked for UPICS, who do clinical documentation reviews and are experts in testifying. We've got people like Wade and Matt and our other team, you know, to be able to explain some of these. But it really is something where I'd be like, oh my God, you know, when I had in every one of my healthcare trials, even in the ones that were kickbacks, I did a lot of bribery cases. We still had somebody who could get on the stand and testify to what Medicare is to understand, like, why is this a thing? It's kind of mind boggling. So it's great insight when we hear stuff like that from someone like you, Sean, on this.
Yeah, I'll tell you the other thing that was really surprising is if you're going to use a post-audit extrapolation, you've got to have somebody, whether it's a statistician or an economist or somebody who understands this stuff to explain it. Again, the government in the last three cases, these were all criminal trials, failed to bring forward a statistician or an expert in advanced mathematics. You know, you put me on the stand, and again, I'm not trying to, make myself, out to be something, that I'm not. But, you put me on the stand, and you say, as a defense counsel during direct examination, you say, Mr. Weiss, can you share with the jury and His Honor, your background in this area? And they say, let's start with statistics. What's your background? Well, I was formally trained in predictive analytic modeling, advanced mathematics, and statistics. Okay. And what does that mean? Well, that means that I understand how to create an audit sample. That means I understand how to test it for flaws. That means I know how to do an extrapolation. I know how to come up with my precision rating, my point estimate, the upper or lower bounds of a 90% confidence interval. And all of a sudden, just the way you guys are kind of nodding your head, all of a sudden you see a jury start going like this and you're like,
right,
you got them.
Right.
And when the prosecution doesn't put somebody on who can argue with what I'm saying, then what I am telling them is the gospel. Because again, and I'll stop here. When the prosecutor objects to a portion of my testimony and Ron Chapman, as an example, in the last case says, Your Honor, he's already been qualified as an expert. And the judge looks at the prosecutor and says, Mr. So-and-so, for the second time, I am explaining to you, Mr. Weiss has been qualified as an expert in this court. If you had an objection to that, you should have raised it during pretrial, arguments. He is an expert. And you see the jury like this, and they're like, he's the expert.
Right.
And it just crushes a case.
Yeah. So while we're in the vein of, statistical sampling and audits and all that, let's kind of shift gears, but stay in that same vein, which is that, you've got a lot of instances where you've got the UPIC does an auditing investigation or an investigative inquiry. They come up with an overpayment and, there's the process. There's the reconsideration, redetermination, and up through the ALJ. And, we've talked about it on our podcasts together. We talk about it on our OIG roundtables. It's a constant topic of conversation because the way that I always like to describe it is in each one of these levels. So you've got, in each one of these appeal levels, and there are three main appeal levels for people that aren't inherently conversant in it. If the UPIC denies a claim and there's an overpayment assessed by the UPIC, an appeal goes to the first level is to go to the MAC, the Medicare Administrative Contractor. The second level is to go to what they call the QUIC, the Quality Improvement Contractor. And then the third level before you go to Federal District Court is an ALJ through the Department Appeals Board. And the one thing that I always explain is that while the UPIC letter that is sent requesting those records says, please provide any and all records, that what oftentimes happens is on these appeals, providers are allowed to introduce new documents. And so what I always say is that the documentation that goes through the levels, it's generally static when it goes from the UPIC to the MAC, to the QUIC, to the ALJ, but it has a level of dynamic for the provider because they get to introduce some additional things all the way up and through. So I want to get your thoughts on that. And then I really want to go to, so Matt oversaw at the UPIC all of this. And so let's just talk about like that process and where you see some of the issues are. And then I want to get some of the thoughts from, from Matt before we close out.
Yeah. So let me just add a couple of points of clarification. you can introduce new information at the administrative law judge level, but it has to be for good cause. Because, you know, everything that you intend to introduce through the first three levels really should be submitted in totality by the second level, which is the QIC, right? The reconsideration. When you go to the administrative law judge, and this is another vital mistake that I think, or critical mistake that I think the government is making. They are not sending anybody from the UPIC. They are not sending anybody from the MAC to show up to counter argue. They're allowing the judges to hear one side of the case and only reviewing documents which could be flawed, which we point out there's a lot of flaws that are being made because they're done by humans. Look, I make mistakes. I you know, we all make mistakes, right? But here's the thing. One of the things that I think judges at the Office of Medicare Hearing and Appeals have become very intolerant of is the submission 24 hours prior to a hearing of a rebuttal statement by the MAC in coordination with a UPIC. And when they fail to send that to opposing counsel, they've already violated the rules of discovery. And it raises the ability for attorneys or for people like myself who are handling ALJ appeals on behalf of my clients to be able to, you know, say to the judge, Your Honor, I realize that you received that, but that was never sent to us. We object to this being entered into evidence. And the judge says, well, there's nobody here from the other side to counter argue that. I agree with you. There's no good cause to admit it. And that just deflates part of the case right there. And then, you know, for me, and, you know, I just say this, I will never go into a case ill-prepared. I will always go into a case thinking, if the prosecutor asks this question, I'm going this direction. If they ask this question, I'm going that direction. I'm always trying to be 2 to 3 steps ahead of where I think they're going, because really, cross-examination is a chess game. That's what it is. It's a chess match. If you move here, I'm moving here. If you move there, I'm moving there. And I hope that I'm going to be able to check and then checkmate on you. I just think that there is a tremendous amount that the UPICs and the MACs could be learning from the number of cases being overturned at the administrative law judge level. And, you know, I've had a chance now to work with Matt. And one of the things that I think the UPICs should really do and do a more concerted job or make a more concerted effort of doing is opening up a discussion period with providers to have a genuine conversation to understand, because I think a lot of times, as you said before, you know, they're using conjecture. They're using circumstantial evidence to make these determinations of fraud. They're convicting people of, you know, False Claims Act or fraud without really hearing the other side. And I think if they would allow for a bona fide discussion to take place and they were open-minded about it, I think a lot of these cases could be resolved at the UPIC level in a civil manner. I wish I would have known Matt when he was the senior director, because the truth is, you know, I backdoor a lot of my conversations because I'm not bound to any, you know, ethics through the Bar Association. So I can have these backdoor conversations to say, look, here's where I think there's some fatal flaws in your argument and in your case. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that so that we can have a good discussion. So you're not losing, you know, and having a high turnover rate at the MAC, which calls into question whether or not they want to renew your contract at the next term. So I'll pause there.
Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, there's a few strings I want to pull on that. First is, yeah, let's look at the process the UPICs have to follow in terms of their investigations. Yeah, we are put on a treadmill through our timeliness metrics. You know, we've got to get the case done and resolved within 180 days. And, you know, that's taking in the data, medical review, all of that stuff has to be done. And it used to be, and I would preach, one of the things you always have to do is interview the provider, take the evidence to them, get their side of the story. You know, sometimes just because of timing, that's not possible. And, you know, even though, you know, as the PD of the Northeast, I pushed for those interviews every time, because even when I was back as an agent before I was a headquarters dweeb, as Eric pointed out, you know, I liked it when defense counsel was there. I liked it when there was subject matter experts to find, you know, what are the weaknesses in my case? Am I trying to criminalize something that's not criminal? Let's get this thing resolved at the right appropriate level. And that's what, you know, we were trying to do in the UPIC. Circumstances sometimes don't allow that. On the need for, you know, UPIC or QUIC or MAC representation in the appeals, I cannot agree more with that. You know, when we as a UPIC were not parties to the ALJ, we are participants. We can go, we can't say anything unless the judge specifically asks us a question. So what we would do, and we spent a lot of resources on this, we would both write position papers that were submitted, and hopefully they were submitted to both sides. And then we would have our statisticians go just in case the judge had questions. And you know, I think we were one of the few people to be there, one of the few parties that would be there, because we could never understand why the QUIC wasn't there, because it's their decisions that are being appealed at that point. It's based on our work going back sometimes a dozen years from when that statistical sampling was done and that extrapolation was done. But it was their decisions that are being appealed. They're never there. So we would appear, you know, we'd have a medical reviewer there if it was our medical review that was done. And we'd also have the statisticians there when it was dealing with an extrapolation. And it cost us a lot of resources, but we were hoping, like you, that the appeals, the appeals were going to be upheld on our end. The other thing I will throw in on that is, you say we should take a look at those things. My ongoing battle with CMS was getting access to those percentages. You know, we'd get some raw numbers, but we never knew, well, which of the claims were upheld? Which ones were denied? Can we get the background on this? We would never receive any of that, because I did want to use it as a training tool.
Yeah, so and that's what handicapped you guys.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, you know, it really comes down to is all of this work is done, all of this effort. It's like, you know, you get dressed for the prom and your date doesn't show up. Like, you've gone all the way through this process, and then you get to the appeal. Yeah, mine didn't show up. That's what I'm saying.
That's so you, that get sounds like jokes, a personal,
you get the yeah. jokes out already. So, you know, but that becomes the challenge. You know, like I would say when I was a working agent, I would say, you know, if I had an allegation and I was working through it and I thought that there was really something there, I'd go to my criminal AUSA. No, we're not interested. Get a declination. I'd go to the civil AUSA. Get a declination. We're not interested. Then I would go to OSIG for a CMP. And if they weren't interested, then return it back, you know, for what it's worth. And so, you know, it's like, you've done all this work, at least see it through to the end. And if you're going to get up to the point of a department appeals board and you're in front of an ALJ and all of the work that you've done needs to be able to be explained in some way, and you just don't get that, you know, you don't get that opportunity. But, you know, it's just, it's a quirk in the process. And I just think it's an interesting thing, right? A little bit of it is whatever the, what's the tolerance or the temperature? You know, yesterday I put a post up on LinkedIn. There was a case out of Western District of New York in Buffalo. It was a Medicaid case. The guy got criminally prosecuted for $12,000, and he was one of three defendants. So each one got held accountable for a third. Now, there may have been some other facts that we don't know about, right? Because sometimes it's the totality. It's not really the dollar amount was your receipt. But, you know, I looked at it, and the point that I was making was in my LinkedIn post was, when you got to the bottom of the press release, when the government thanks the participating agencies, the list of participating agencies was unbelievable. There had to have been a half a dozen organizations that were involved in the investigation. And so it's like, is the juice worth the squeeze? Was the use of the resources worth it? And it then, so to kind of bring this to full circle, if you're going to say it's worth our resources to have a process in place for reconsiderations, redeterminations, and ALJ, shouldn't you at least support that process through to the end? You know, once you've made your decision and you've handed it off, then you've expressed in nonverbal terms that the resource allocation isn't worth it, right? And Sean, we're running out of time, so we got to talk, but I want to get your last thought on that, because I know when you and I always speak, it's always about what is the proper use of the people and the time and the effort.
Yeah. So here's what I would say, right? There's no doubt that there is an over-criminalization that's been taking place. We've entered, you and I have talked about this numerous times. Matt, you and I have had a chance to talk about this. You know, we've entered into a new era of investigations. We've entered into a new era of aggressiveness in auditing, in overzealous prosecutors. I think really what I would chalk it up to is it's a different generation that is being asked to carry the torch forward without being given the proper tools and having the proper demeanor to be able to do it. $12,000 criminalization, you know, could that have been handled in a civil matter, you know, in a civil manner? Could it have been held, you know, handled in an administrative manner? You know, possibly, you know, there may be some underlying, you know, things that took place, and that's just kind of how it went down. But when I hear of, you know, 32 government agencies being dragged into a $12,000 criminal case, and the government's bragging about getting a guilty verdict on that, it just makes me shake my head in disbelief. What I hope would happen, and, you know, I've had a chance to befriend Kenneth Polite, who is second in command at the Justice Department. You know, he's over the criminal division at Justice. I think he's bringing a breath of fresh air to this most recent generation of prosecutors. I think he's holding them accountable. I think he's forcing them to use prosecutorial discretion on filing charges versus trying to get everybody around the table and get a settlement agreement or get a deferred prosecutorial agreement or something like that. I would like to see more discussions prior to pleadings being filed. That's going to cost not only the taxpayers hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, but the same for defense, for the defendants. You know, healthcare is not going away. It's a $1 trillion industry. We're never going to go to a single payer system. We're never going to be socialized. I think if you really want to fix the problem, and I hope you gentlemen would agree with me, if you really want to fix the problem, you got to change it from a pay and chase system. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. There's not enough resources that are available to be able to chase down all of this money. And when you start chasing down money from claims that were submitted 6 years ago, 7 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, it just creates an intolerable situation, and it creates a lot of bad faith between providers and insurance companies. And I think there needs to be more power granted to the insurance commissioners to monitor the behavior of the commercial payers, because they're more aggressive. And I think they are truly the bad actors in the industry when it comes to audits and then escalating things to district attorneys or then up to the Department of Justice. I've seen so many cases that never should have been escalated beyond just an administrative process, but because they dug their heels in and they wanted to extract their pound of flesh, they pushed this thing as far as they could, only to get slapped down in district court or in federal court. So, you know, I'd love to see some changes. I don't know if we will in, you know, anytime soon, but you got to start with changing the pay and chase system.
So, you know, one of the things, and we'll close with this, you know, one of the things that we do here at Advise is we do a lot of SIU process improvement recommendations and analyses and things. One of the things that we have really been pushing to our payer SIU clients when we do this is the insertion of a law enforcement liaison, because those are the people, you know, people like Wade, Matt, and I, and our other OIG, you know, there's probably about a half a dozen of us that are here at Advise. And I'm proud to say that I've, you know, been instrumental in recruiting some, and Wade and Matt, and we've all been recruiting, you know, because we think we bring a little bit of that sort of homeostasis, that normalcy. And one of the things that we really try to do is talk about bringing a law enforcement liaison into the mix, because we speak healthcare, we speak the legal, and sometimes we're able to provide a little bit of a voice of reason that maybe is missing in the communication or what have you. Does everything need to go to a district attorney or a prosecutor or a MAFUCA or whatever? You know, how can we resolve this? And really, do the facts warrant spending that time, you know, to do that? And, you know, understanding that while that is sitting with someone making an assessment, the provider is in the wing, right? They're just in the wind waiting to see what happens. So, you know, it's an interesting point. So we spent a lot of time. I really appreciate you being on, Sean, as always. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about these topics. We're going to have you back again, because I do want to talk a lot more about a lot of other things in the industry. So it was great to have you on. As always, Wade and Matt, it's good to see you guys on this. So we appreciate it. For those of you that do not get our newsletter, there's always a link to these podcasts on our newsletter, or you can always get our newsletter by sending an email to us at hello@advisehealth.com. And we can include you in our newsletter where you can get this. You can also get all of our recordings, our podcasts, OIG Roundtable, our LinkedIn Live. After the live event, it's recorded. It is put up on our YouTube channel. You just need to go to YouTube, take a look for Advise Health. You can find it. You can find Sean. He is very prolific on the web, in social media, primarily on LinkedIn, as well as his daily compliance guy stuff. So, you know, find him as well. I tune in very frequently, because I will tell you that there is a lot of information that comes out of those conversations that he has on that. So to all of you, thanks again for joining, and we'll see you on our next OIG Roundtable and our next OIG Files and our LinkedIn Lives. Thanks for being on, Sean. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.